Prologue. The Steps. The architect Cass Gilbert had grand ambitions for his design of a new home for the Supreme Court, what he called the greatest tribunal in the world, one of the three great elements of our national government. Gilbert knew that the approach to the court, as much as the structure itself, would define the experience of the building. But the site presented a challenge. Other exalted Washington edifices, the Capitol, the Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial, inspired awe with their processional approaches. But in 1928, Congress had designated for the court a cramped and asymmetrical plot of land, wedged tightly between the Capitol and the Library of Congress. How could Gilbert convey to visitors the magnitude and importance of the judicial process taking place within the court's walls? The answer, he decided, was steps. Gilbert pushed back the wings of the building so that the public face of the building would be a portico with a massive and imposing stairway. Visitors would not have to walk a long distance to enter, but few would forget the experience of mounting those 44 steps to the double row of 8 massive columns supporting the roof. The walk up the stairs would be the central symbolic experience of the Supreme Court, a physical manifestation of the American march to justice. The stairs separated the court from the everyday world, and especially from the earthly concerns of the politicians in the Capitol, and announced that the justices would operate literally on a higher plane. That, in any event, was the theory. The truth about the court has always been more complicated. For more than 200 years, the Supreme Court has confronted the same political issues as the other branches of government, with a similar mixed record of success and failure. During his long tenure as Chief Justice, John Marshall did as much as the framers of the Constitution themselves to shape an enduring structure for the government of the United States. In the decades that followed, however, the court fared no better than presidents or the Congress in ameliorating the horror of slavery or avoiding civil war. Likewise, during the period of territorial and economic expansion before World War I, the court again shrank from a position of leadership, mostly preferring to accommodate the business interests and their political allies, who also dominated the other branches of government. It was not until the 1950s and 1960s, and the tenure of Chief Justice Earl Warren, that the court consistently asserted itself as an independent and aggressive guarantor of constitutional rights. For the next 30 years, through the tenures of Chief Justices Warren E. Burger and William H. Rehnquist, the court stood nearly evenly divided on the most pressing issues before it. On race, sex, religion, and the power of the federal government, the subjects that produced the enduring controversies, control of the court generally belonged to the moderate swing justices, first Lewis F. Powell, and then Sandra Day O'Connor, who steered the court in line with their own cautious instincts, which were remarkably similar to those of the American people. The result was a paradox. Like all their predecessors, the justices belonged to a fundamentally anti-democratic institution. They were not elected. They were not accountable to the public in any meaningful way. Their life tenure gave them no reason to cater to the will of the people. Yet, the touchstones of the years 1992 to 2005 on the Supreme Court were decisions that reflected public opinion with great precision. The opinions were issued in the court's customary language of legal certainty, announced as if the constitutional text and precedents alone mandated their conclusions. But the decisions in these cases probably would have been the same if they had simply been put up for a popular vote. That, now, may be about to change. Through the tense standoff of the Burger and Rehnquist years, a powerful conservative rebellion against the court was building. It has been, in many respects,